It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farish. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, one of the world's most famous drag queens, who also happens to be from Wisconsin, tells us about her work as a performance artist. First, after a chaotic weekend, President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure deal appears to be back on. But now there's a new hurdle, this time from progressives in Biden's own party who say they may not support the plan if a second bill with more liberal priorities doesn't pass at the same time. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about the Biden administration's struggle to keep Democrats on board with infrastructure and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the narrower bipartisan infrastructure deal pass on its own? Or do you think Democrats should hold out to try to get a second bill with things like universal preschool and climate change policies passed at roughly the same time? What questions do you have next about what comes next on infrastructure? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back. Well, Ginger, before we get to some of our planned topics, so we learned today that former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has passed away at age 88. Can you talk some about Rumsfeld's role in Washington and reactions you're hearing so far?
I mean, Donald Rumsfeld is probably going to be best known for his role as former President George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, during which he was the face of the administration's insistence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that the U.S. needed to launch an attack on them to prevent them from being used. Considered the architect of the Iraq war. But Rumsfeld worked in public service for decades. He had served previously as the Secretary of Defense. He was a Republican power broker and really also a mentor to some Republicans as they were coming up through the ranks in government, in the party, and was really beloved, even if sort of the public perception of him was so closely tied to Iraq. Many others felt differently about him, and I think we're going to hear and are hearing in the early moments after the announcement by his family that he has died, those type of remembrances of him.
Well, I mentioned infrastructure, Ginger, the deal on between the president and a bipartisan group of senators then looked shaky and now on again. Can you give us some of the back and forth from the last week or so on this?
Yeah, so we have this big deal that was struck by the president and Republicans, this infrastructure deal. But you're right, it has been shaky. We have heard a lot of questions about whether or not the Democrats are even going to be on board with this. There's been some pushback we heard today from Chris Murphy suggesting that if Democrats couldn't put everything they wanted into the big bill, that they wouldn't vote for the smaller bipartisan agreement. So there's a lot of work left to be done by the president, by Democratic leaders on getting this this done.
Let's focus in on this sort of two-track deal, Ginger, because it gets a little confusing. On the one hand, if I have this right, there's this bipartisan agreement, at least among some senators, saying, yes, this narrow thing on what we usually have called infrastructure in the past, the roads, bridges, that sort of thing. Then there's this and hopes that they could pass that in the normal way in the Senate, and then a Democratic supported bill with more progressive priorities that would have to pass. It wouldn't get any Republican support. It would have to pass through that reconciliation process where the Democrats could pass it if they could get all 50 senators, Democratic senators on board. Did I sort that out about right?
Yes, you did. That's a pretty concise summary of what Congress is looking to do. Now, look, we should start by saying getting anything through Congress is always difficult. And so now we're talking about getting two separate pieces of legislation. That's two votes. That's two different competing interests. It's a lot more than just one piece of legislation. And so you're right. This is this bipartisan agreement. And this is going to go via what we would call, or what lawmakers would call, regular order. So it's going to have to get 60 votes from Republicans to clear a filibuster, and it's going to have to pass both chambers. And then there's this reconciliation, and this is kind of like a parliamentary hat trick, right? You sort of a sleight of hand to get around the filibuster. And so it only needs Democratic votes. And this isn't unprecedented. Democrats have used this before, and Republicans used it to put through their tax breaks in 2017. So there's a precedent for this. And what we're seeing now is starting to be an inter-Democratic disagreement where they can't decide just how much money they should spend and just how much taxes they should raise. And they're starting to show signs that some of them could try to cause some problems on both fronts if they don't get what they want on that bill.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital, looking at some of the top stories in the nation's capital right now. Infrastructure, maybe a deal finally in the works. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on what you want to see come out of this, if you have questions about what's going on, give a call or email ideas@WPR.org. Want to give a listen, Ginger, to White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, asked about this dispute amongst Democrats over linking the two bills today. Here's what she had to say.
We think the American people are most focused on what this is going to do for them and less on the process. It's up to leaders in Congress to move this forward. The president looks forward to signing both pieces of legislation into law.
But Ginger, if the process doesn't work, these bills aren't going to do anything for people, right? I mean, the process has to go through to make these things pass.
That's right. You have to sort of get through some of these things. And you know, this is the sausage making that Washington talks so much about. And I think for some of your listeners, I mean, they don't care how Congress gets it done. They don't really care if it's a reconciliation filibuster skirting bill or it's one bill or two bills. They care if the bridge and their community gets rebuilt. They care if they have broadband internet. I mean, we talk about broadband, but listeners in Wisconsin, that's a real thing, parts of the state where you can't get broadband internet. And that's a provision that's being discussed in this. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth in Washington, but at the end of the day, it's about what shovel gets put in the ground and whether or not that happens.
Ginger, can you tell us a little more about the shovels in the bipartisan one now, the normal order plan? How many shovels are we talking about? How much money? What are the key priorities there?
Yeah, we're talking about a rather large bill. So in the bipartisan agreement that was struck between the president, as you said, and some senators, in that case, we're talking about what they're calling physical infrastructure. So this is roads, bridges. It's got some climate pieces, you know, pieces that are considered climate, particularly coastal issues that would address some erosion issues along the coast, but not the energy or the electric vehicles that some Democrats wanted. It's got some money for broadband, which is a bipartisan agreement. And all in all, it's a $579 billion package, and a package that Democrats are hoping, or Republicans are hoping, they can get some buy-on from some of their other members, because it is those things that they traditionally have been very popular.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, hi.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm confused. Biden, it seems like everything that Biden does, the Democrats say he's just exceeding our expectations, and the Republicans seem to think he's made a deal with Beelzebub, and it seems like he has turned back every single campaign promise that he made. He was going to do single payer. He was going to do $15, first off, out of the gate, $15 an hour, and cancel student debt, or he was going to reduce it, not cancel it, but $50,000 a student. Free college, technical college. We can't go the 4 years.
I gotcha, Randy. So Randy's seeing the president, Ginger, turning away from some of his campaign promises. I don't remember single payer as a Biden promise, though. Some of the others do ring a bell, though.
You know, the other thing, it's it's one of those things where what were his campaign promises? He didn't promise single payer. He didn't promise to cancel student debt. In fact, he tried to do everything he could to not even come close to promising getting rid of student debt. And he's sort of also now trying to delay and delay. My coworker, Lauren Egan, did a great story a couple weeks ago about how the White House said they were going to have a memo on whether or not he even could cancel student debt in April. And here we are looking at July tomorrow, and we still haven't gotten that memo. And I think it's interesting. When I think about Biden's biggest promises on the campaign trail, I think about COVID and I think about infrastructure. His whole campaign slogan was Build Back Better, and it was meant to be COVID-focused and to be infrastructure-focused. And I saw a joke the other day when they were announcing this infrastructure deal. They did so maskless in a group outside the White House that he had sort of delivered on two of his promises as symbolized there. But I do think that he is still trying to plow through those agenda items. He hasn't yet really been confronted with something unexpected that he has to redirect his attention. And those other things, I think we're going to see him try to address in a way that he can. And I think he is constantly aware, perpetually aware of the national dynamic and whether or not this is viewed as partisan versus not partisan. And for that reason, I think things like student loans are something that he knows is very popular with his base, but he wants to make sure he doesn't do it in a way that really upsets Republicans.
Thanks for the call, Randy. We'll go to Lee now in Milwaukee. Lee, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to mention, Lee?
I just wanted to say that I think that passing the bipartisan version should definitely happen. I think we should absolutely shoot for these more pie-in-the-sky ideas, these more social ideas that these other Democrats want. But right now, our roads are literally crumbling out from underneath our feet, and anything is better than what we got. We have to make progress in any way. Take it like a marathon and not a sprint, you know?
Lee, thanks a lot for the call. Ginger, is there talk in Congress along those lines? Take what we can get now and maybe work on that other stuff later?
I mean, that's just a really complicated puzzle that House Democrats are having to put together, right? You have to get enough votes. And there are some very liberal people in Congress who are saying that if they only do a piece of it, they'll be failing, right? That it's not enough and that they would rather blow the whole thing up than get just a small piece. I'm not sure that's a position that's going to last very long. It feels like a negotiating position, like they're just trying to get more through it, and that if push came to shove and they could only do the smaller package, that ultimately they probably would. It's a little bit kind of also like Democrats to sort of go ahead and take what they can get. And Republicans shut the government down in 2013 to try to repeal Obamacare. It's not in Democrats' nature to sort of do that kind of thing. And I think for that reason, it is a good chance we see something get done, that we see some type of progress. And let's also be clear, funding infrastructure used to be such a bipartisan thing that it would not have been something we would have considered hard or difficult. So this is not exactly the highest bar.
Lee, thanks for that call. We're talking to Ginger Gibson from NBC News Digital. She's with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, what do you want to see from a January 6th commission? What do you want to see it investigate? The House passed, put that commission into practice, not what they had tried for initially. What do you want to see happen there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics now with Ginger Gibson from NBC News Digital. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The U.S. House has voted this afternoon to create a select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol. What do you think about that? Call it at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you think needs to be investigated? Do you wish we had had the 9/11 investigation style committee that was originally proposed? 800-642-1234 is the number. Ginger, what do we got? What is this committee looking like now?
So the House voted just a few moments ago to approve this committee. And what we're going to find out sometime soon in the next hours or days is who's going to be in charge of this committee and who is going to be on this committee. So it's 13 House members, won't include any senators. And the way that the legislation that authorizes it is written is that Nancy Pelosi will choose the 13 members, or she will name the 13 members, five of who will be named in consultation with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. And that's a little bit of an interesting language because she can consult, but she doesn't have to necessarily do what McCarthy tells her. So if McCarthy comes back and says he wants all members who have insisted that there was no riot at all, which a couple of them have, she cannot include them. And then Pelosi has also said that she's considering, of the eight members that are entirely up to her discretion, naming a Republican. In order to sort of get the balance of that committee a little bit closer to parity, it would be 7 to 6 a Democrat-Republican split if Pelosi did that. And key here, there were two Republicans who voted for this committee, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who have been very critical of Donald Trump, who voted to impeach him. So they weren't surprising. But now those are considered the two Republicans that we might see Pelosi add to this committee.
What do we know about what this commission, however it ends up being constituted, is intended to look into? What particulars?
So they're pretty limited to just January the 6th. So they can look into what led up to it and what happened on that day. That had been sort of when they were talking about doing a commission instead of a committee, that had been sort of a big point of contention. Republicans wanted a lot more covered. They wanted general political unrest to be included, and Democrats told them no. And there was some push by Democrats as well to make this basically a Trump investigation. And it seems that is not going to be permitted either. But this will look a lot into Trump, into Trump's allies, into his organization, into what role they were playing in bringing people, attracting people to Washington for this event, and then telling people to go to the Capitol. And I think that's going to be a pervasive subject in here because it is such a key part of this debate and discussion and what happened. And then also, you know, how did they get in the building? You know, lots of us, including myself, who was there that day, all thought this is the safest building in the world. No one's going to get inside. We were wrong. And so doing some deeper explanations and understandings of some of the mechanics of what happened that day.
Let's bring on a caller now. Bill is with us in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. The only thing I got to say about the January 6th committee is, no, let's just be done with it. The horse, we beat the dead horse. Pelosi just coming up with more stuff to keep ragging on Trump, even though he's not in office anymore. I don't know how many more times they're going to try to impeach Trump, 3, 4, 5 more times, and just keep vilifying the Republican Party. It wasn't the Republican Party's fault that, a rogue bunch of people went in there. We got better things to do.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And Ginger, are we hearing that from some Republicans in the House who voted against this?
I mean, I think we're hearing from Republicans that they think that this is just going to be partisan. The sort of saying the quiet part out loud, too, which is that they think any investigation that stretches into next year politically will be bad for them ahead of the midterm elections. And I do think that there's a risk for Democrats. I mean, we can look at the House Republicans' efforts to investigate Benghazi. It was attack on a U.S. consulate. Americans, including the ambassador, were killed. It was a terrible event. Republicans' efforts to try to make this about Hillary Clinton dragged it out in a way with tons of hearings and investigations that stopped being about actual security feelings and became very partisan and political and accomplished very little in trying to make our embassies safer, our consulates safer. Democrats know that that is something that they risk, that if they, you know, as the caller said, beat the dead horse, that there could be a political risk for them. But they think that there are still elements of this. There has not been sort of a 30,000 foot, a holistic look at what happened and who was involved and the roles that people played, and that they can do that without a political risk. But be clear that especially for voters who care more about what the kitchen table issues, as they like to say, that there could risk sort of turning some of them off.
Bill, thanks for that call. Ginger, I want to take a quick look before we run out of time at police reform legislation. We've been seeing negotiations going on in Congress over this. Where is that right now?
You know, there looks to be some progress happening on this issue. They are talking, they have been talking, but as we had a great story from Leanne Caldwell this week on NBCNews.com, some of those, like, rosy depictions of progress may be not quite showing as clearly how much of a problem behind closed doors there is. We're seeing feuding between sheriffs and police groups. And every time we think that they've come to an agreement on qualified immunity, it turns out that maybe they don't have an agreement on qualified immunity. And for those of you who don't know what qualified immunity is, because it is a very jargony term, it's a legal doctrine, so it's not a law, but it's something that the courts have established that says that police, when they actions taken while on duty, have a higher bar in order for them to be sued if something bad happens. So if they think that they're acting within the law, there's a certain amount of protections. Now, they don't have blanket protections. It's not like you can't sue a police officer for something he's done on duty, but it's much, much harder. And Democrats want to get rid of that, and Republicans think it's kind of important because there could be lots of things that an officer must do in the course of their work that is the doing the best they can to protect the public. And if they don't have some protection, if they're going to be sued, they think that they risk losing a lot of officers that way. So it is a really sort of in the weeds fight, but it is something that if they could come to some agreement, then I think they will have a police reform bill before the year is over.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC News Digital. She was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in the nation's capital. Coming up after the news, on the last day of Pride, drag queen Trixie Mattel, originally from Wisconsin, by the way, tells us about her craft, her songwriting, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, some corporate brands and internet communities have languages of their own that start to sound kind of like cults. Meet the author of the new book, Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, to mark the end of Pride Month, we decided to talk to one of the most famous drag queens in the world who happens to be from Wisconsin, the one and only Trixie Mattel.
Stepping to the plate, I'm Trixie Mattel. Got my name in the game, better learn it well. Cause I'm the MVP heading up to bat. And I'll go to third base, but I'd never tell that. I got bleach in the
blonde. Trixie Mattel is the stage name of Brian Michael Furcus. Trixie's a Wisconsin native, a UW-Milwaukee alum, and the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 3. I talked to her yesterday about drag, her co-ownership of Wisconsin's oldest gay bar, and more. Well, let's start with some 2021 news here in Wisconsin. You recently became co-owner of the oldest gay bar here in the state. This Is It in Milwaukee. Can you talk about your connection and your hopes for the future of the bar?
Well, you know, if you're gay and you want to buy a bar and you want to feel young, you have to buy one of the old ones, right? you know, I needed a bar where we have sometimes literally 70-year-old men coming to happy hour so that I can feel young. This bar was started in 1968, and which isn't when I started going there, ha ha ha, but I started going at 21. I'm 31 now, so 10 years ago. And I remember walking in, it was one of my first gay bars I ever went to, and the bartender was like, I don't recognize you. What's your name? Can I make you a drink? And the bartender was George Schneider, who's my co-owner now. We own the bar together, so it was full circle. Basically, I could say, like, it's important to preserve queer spaces and being part of the community. Basically, I wanted to make sure no matter what happened in my career, I had somewhere to drink for free.
So, and it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Are there changes in the works? You're not just, like you say, preserving a piece of history here.
Well, I am sort of like a this is it. The preservation of this is it society. I am sort of like the leader. So, you know, you would think Trixie buying a bar, I would just walk in and start throwing pink paint on everything. But I really like the bar how it is. It itself is sort of a clubhouse that's been shaped by queer culture for decades. So I'm just about keeping more eyes on what we already have that's great. So, you know, my goal would be to make This Is It more of like a national landmark where people, like in New York, you have Stonewall. And then This Is It, in Milwaukee, you have This Is It, which is actually older than Stonewall.
Now, you're a singer, actor, musician. What made you first realize you wanted to be a performer?
Well, I don't know. I guess I just always liked the idea of, like, dressing up and pretending something was happening. I don't know. Like, that was something I did as a kid that never really went away.
And
costumes and makeup and everything just stayed part of it, the way when you're a kid, dressing up is part of it.
You were here in Wisconsin. You were at UW-Madison, I think, studying performance. Can you talk about the first time you went up in front of people as a drag performer?
Sure. I was in UW-Milwaukee, and I was there studying musical theater. So I was during the day I was taking, you know, singing and dancing and all that. And then at nights, I was doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee. And then when I turned 21, I started working in nightclubs. So by the time I finished my college education, I was already doing drag like 3-4 nights a week in Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago. So that was just sort of my career when I finished college. Like, I could pay all my bills performing, so I already felt like, you know, rich.
And now you're a folk musician. You play auto harp and guitar. I want to hear some of your song, Moving Parts. We'll play a little here.
Sometimes there's a danger of choking on the parts. No one gave a warning to the breaking of your heart. Pick up all the pieces and go back to the start. Never losing, only using all your moving parts. All your moving parts.
Love the harmony there. Are you harmonizing yourself in a studio, or do you have a backup there?
No, that was just me and my friend Brandon. We had like a little, that was just a one take. I went in a booth with the harp, and he went in a booth to sing by himself, and we just had glass between us, and we were just like, let's just do it once, and then whatever it is, it is. So that was just us singing it together.
Fantastic. Talk about some of your musical influences. Who inspires you as a musical performer?
Well, you know, I really got into songwriting because of folk music. So I love like Amy Mann and Emmylou Harris and Jason Isbell. I love like song craftsmans. But I'm also, you know, a performer. And so I really like high concept sort of performance artists too. So I love the B-52s. I love I love Blondie. I love the Go-Go's. I love Fountains of Wayne is one of my all-time favorite bands. And recently, I don't know, I find inspiration all over the place. I find with Trixie, she kind of shifts decades visually as she sort of shifts musical inspiration. Recently, I've been really into house and EDM, which I would have never thought I would like. And I don't know why. I guess after COVID, I went to my first like nightclub and I was like, oh my God, music. You know, so now I'm like a 31-year-old man who puts on dance music and dances alone in his house.
Can you talk about developing the identity of Trixie? Is this something that did she just spring fully formed for your mind, or?
Yes, it was very much. I didn't know I was pregnant. Well, I always loved Barbie, and I always loved My Little Pony and Polly Pocket and Girl Toys, but I wasn't really allowed to play with Girl Toys as a little kid. So when I drafted the character, you know, in the early sketches of it, you know, like the early ideas of it, I guess I knew that women were women and drag queens pretended to be women. And I wanted to be something more than that, like something it looks like you would pull the string on the back and it would talk. I wanted to look completely fabricated and factory made. And I wanted this character to be sort of this sort of critique on America's favorite fashion doll, because my sense of humor is very dark. So I knew if I dressed like a kid's toy, but my jokes and my songs and stuff were very racy, I thought it would be like a winning combination. And it was.
I think a lot of people associate drag specifically with LGBTQ culture, but clearly it's got an audience outside of that as well. What do you think is the appeal of drag performance, in-person shows, TV shows, of course, with RuPaul's Drag Race? What is it that appeals to this wider audience?
Well, you know what's funny? There's certain things that, like, straight culture, I guess, if straight people have a culture, I don't know, but they've always liked drag. They just didn't always call it drag. So if you think of, like, the movie White Chicks, or if you think of Madea or Mrs. Doubtfire, it's like, well, that all is drag. We just didn't really call it drag. But what's great is people are more and more accepting all the time. And when you become open-minded, you become accepting of things you didn't know about and you find new things you like. I mean, that's just like universal. And I think that in America especially, we're so afraid of sex and gender. And drag throws a nuclear bomb and all of that. So when you enjoy drag and you go, oh, I thought this was going to be something at its core, drag is really just like, you know, it's your Halloween closet. You're playing dress up and lip syncing for your friends. It's kind of, you know, it can be offensive. There can be, you know, people stapling money to themselves and stuff, but really at its core, it's just playing dress up.
Now, you're in the same boat as a lot of performers have been this last year plus now. You love to perform in front of people, but that's been shut off by the pandemic. How antsy are you to just get back to your normal schedule of performing?
Oh, I am very ready. Listen, after I was very spoiled because I had, you know, TV shows and my YouTube channel and stuff to do all year. So I had a venue all year, but I miss real people. Like, the other day I introduced a film at the Hollywood Cemetery here in LA. I introduced Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and there was 4,000 people there. And when I walked out and they said my name and everyone screamed, I was like, I haven't had this happen in so long. I'm dying to get back on the road with my show Grown Up, because that tour was interrupted in the middle of a world tour. So now I have to go back and listen to the recordings of Grown Up, my tour, and relearn all the cues and stuff.
Are you going to be performing at This Is It, or are there secret plans that you don't want to spill on that yet?
Well, let's just say that, you know, now that I'm part owner, I definitely appear more often. I was there for the end of May, May 30th, I think. I was there performing and we had like a little outdoor shindig. We broke the drink sales record since 1968. We had the most drink sales of all time at the bar. So we're coming out of COVID strong. People are ready to drink, put on fancy shirts, and watch crossdressers twirl.
It's a great place to leave it. Trixie, thanks again for joining us.
Of course. Thank you. See ya. This is it.
That was Trixie Mattel, drag queen and new co-owner of Wisconsin's oldest gay bar. That's in Milwaukee. Next up, Wisconsin author Dick Wagner joins us to talk about the history of LGBTQ rights here in the state. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember when Wisconsin passed the nation's first gay rights law back in 1982? What was your reaction at the time? What questions do you have about Wisconsin's history? That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we're talking about the history of LGBTQ rights in Wisconsin. Our next guest says the state has a history of being ahead of the curve on gay rights. Wisconsin made history in 1982 by passing the first gay rights law in the country. Dick Wagner is an activist and author of two books about Wisconsin's LGBTQ history, We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History, and Coming Out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History. He became the first openly gay member of the Dane County Board of Supervisors in 1980. Dick, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here again.
As you write in your books, a lot of people look to the coasts for the history of developments of gay rights in the United States. You say there's a lot of story to tell here in Wisconsin. Can you share a little bit of that with us?
Sure. I may be a Midwest chauvinist, but not all gay history happened on the coast. And as you mentioned, Wisconsin was the first state to pass a gay rights law. In fact, in the decade of the 1980s, the legislature passed five significant pro-LGBTQ measures. And it was passed with both Republican and Democratic support. And I try to reflect that in that the second volume has a foreword by both Senator Tammy Baldwin and former Congressman Steve Gunderson, Republican and Democrat, to show that bipartisan nature.
What is it that led to that bipartisan agreement to do this kind of law that wasn't happening elsewhere in the country?
There were still a lot of progressives from the time of the La Follettes who had gone back into the Republican Party who were in the legislature, and they cast some votes for the early consenting adults bill to decriminalize homosexuality, and they weren't punished for that. In fact, many of them advanced further in their political careers after being supportive of gay rights issues, with enough Democrats and some progressive Republicans, Wisconsin moved ahead of the nation in this area.
And you call in your book Wisconsin a gay laboratory of democracy. Was Wisconsin the first stone to fall? Did it lead other states to consider similar legislation?
Yes. In fact, some of the Wisconsin equal rights administrators would go and testify at other states. Wisconsin was issuing the first brochures about state non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. It was training how to enforce the law. It was working with the community about how to file complaints. And so Wisconsin really was showing the nation how it could be done ahead of everybody else.
Can you share a little of your own story when you decided to come out and become an openly gay politician at a time when that wasn't a combination of words you usually heard in this country?
No, it wasn't. But part of it was the assassination of Harvey Milk in San Francisco and his testament about urging people to come out. And I had begun to be active with the Gay Center in Madison on their advisory committee, and then was doing fundraisers for them, things like an Alice B. Toklas birthday party. And so it just was a point when I thought I should do it, and I did, and I've never looked back.
Talking to Dick Wagner, longtime activist, former politician, author of two books about Wisconsin's gay history. We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History, and Coming Out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History. Dick, we just heard Trixie Mattel talk about her co-ownership now of This Is It, the oldest gay bar in Wisconsin. That's in Milwaukee. A lot of history happens at gay bars. The Stonewall Inn in New York City eventually led to what we now call a Pride Day and Pride Month. Can you talk a little bit about the history of gay bars here in Wisconsin?
Sure. Pre-Stonewall, there were a number of bars that were accepting gay clientele. So we had places where community was being built. And some of the early efforts to organize on behalf of gay rights, they would raise money in those bars, sometimes just from the coat checks. And then you had the Hotel Washington complex, Rodney Shields' bar complex here in Madison. And Madison had passed in 1975 an ordinance on gay rights, and then it was threatened by the Anita Bryant effort across the country. And so Rodney brought the so-called Party Hardy crew from the bars into the political movement against the Anita Bryant effort, with the magic picnic here in Madison. And so you had this joining of political forces and social forces to fight back against that, and it was successful. Madison did not repeal its gay rights ordinance, contrary to some other places around the country. And all of that led to the momentum for the state gay rights law that would follow.
Are there a couple of particular individuals you would like to point out and make more household names over the course of that history?
Well, Lloyd Barbie was really the prophet of sex reform in the state, an African-American assemblyman from Milwaukee. And he may have introduced the first marriage equality law just following Stonewall in the 1971 legislature, as well as earlier measures to decriminalize homosexuality and to have non-discrimination based on sexual orientation. So he was one of those real prophets that is often overlooked in Wisconsin.
Now, we've been talking about a lot about this 1982 law. That's just about 40 years ago. Where do you see Wisconsin stacking up since then when it comes to laws, protections related to gay people in Wisconsin?
Well, the laws actually have empowered a whole bunch of organizations and people around the state to organize and come out and feel protected. There's still a lot of fight in Wisconsin that's needed for transgendered rights since we were ahead of the curve and we did not include those, unfortunately, in 82. But Governor Tony Evers right now has been leading some executive actions in that area, and he would be likely to veto any anti-trans laws that might pass the legislature. So we're in a pretty good place, but not as good as we should be.
A big part of the story, especially back in the 80s, was the AIDS crisis, which hit, especially in the early days, the gay community hardest. Can you talk about how Wisconsin weathered that decade or so in the early days?
Well, Wisconsin actually had some important early leadership in Governor Earle, who, with his health secretary, got in contact with the State Medical Society. And they initially put out a statement very strong in terms of urging humane treatment for AIDS patients. And then the state Department of Equal Rights ruled that AIDS was a disability and would be protected under state law. And so this is a time when, under the Reagan National Administration, they were saying you could fire AIDS people. And here in Wisconsin, because of the leadership of the Earle administration, we were being protected. And indeed, Governor Earle also supported HIV confidentiality provisions at a time when testing was talked about as a way to try and quarantine and fire people who might be HIV positive.
Part of the reason, Dick, I think you wrote your books, if I understand correctly, was to make sure we don't forget this history we've been talking about so far. Why is it important to you that we keep these stories front and center?
Well, it's important to me because this is part of Wisconsin's tradition, an openness and a willingness to embrace people and to evolve our laws to reflect changing society. The Wisconsin Idea, which talked about how the boundaries of the state, if you think of the social boundaries at the time when President Van Hise of the university spoke of that, it did not include LGBTQ people. Today, clearly, LGBTQ people are part of the state of Wisconsin, and so all of this history is important so that we become a more inclusive society, and that's an important story of Wisconsin.
And in our last just minute or so, what part of that ongoing story are you watching right now in 2021?
I'm watching how we begin to articulate how trans rights and knowledge are growing. One of the things that was important to me was that Wisconsin gay media helped dispel the ignorance about homosexuality. Today there's tremendous ignorance about trans issues, and we need to dispel that ignorance so people can come to rational questions and rational answers in dealing with the trans community.
Do you see an opportunity to spread that word and bring people together on an issue like this that we could do in 1982?
Yes, there are opportunities, and local communities have been advancing some of those issues in their local ordinances. And again, that was a pattern that occurred in the 70s where we used local political power to build non-discrimination ordinances like Madison and Milwaukee and Dane County before the state ordinance. And so there is still an effort in Wisconsin to build this kind of effort from the ground up, and that leads me to hope.
Dick, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to do it.
That's Dick Wagner, activist and author of two books about Wisconsin's LGBTQ history. We've been here all along, Wisconsin's early gay history, and coming out moving forward, Wisconsin's recent gay history. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the tragic building collapse in Florida has people worried about large buildings around the country. A civil engineering expert joins the show for a look at the risk and how to prevent future collapses. State governments around the country are putting limits on college curriculums, and a couple of them are creating ideological tests for campuses. We'll find out what's going on and what it means for higher education and how we talk about race. And text messages have become a big part of our relationships, and the pandemic may have made them even bigger. We'll find out how love works, one message at a time. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Online work meetings and family and friend gatherings have been big over the last year. It's had its challenges and ups and downs, but for the most part, it's been better than nothing. And in some ways, even better than that, because some people have found ways to have fun with it. As reported by Inside Edition, a Washington, D.C. resident had a running inside joke. She started wearing the same flower print Hawaiian shirt to online meetings day after day. She thought she'd do it until somebody noticed. But then something happened. Nothing happened. No one noticed, or at least her colleagues didn't say anything about it. So she kept wearing the shirt. Sometimes she mixed it up with a different undershirt or jacket. She kept count and made it up to 264 Zoom meetings in the same shirt. She finally revealed the secret when she left for a new job. She says she hasn't worn the shirt to the new job, not yet anyway. We all find ways to make our own fun. I try to be the first one to online meetings and then sing a little song about the fact that I'm the only one at the meeting so far. So the second person to the meeting gets to hear part of it. Been doing it for a long time, and everyone still finds it hilarious. Right? Yeah. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.